Hello, I'm Jane Buchanan, and I'm here to do the oral history of Jennifer Sharon Stock. It's March 23rd, 2018, and we are at the Actors Fund in New York City. Hello, Jennifer. Jennifer, I wanted to ask you a beginning question. Tell us something about your background and what may have inspired you to choose a life in the theater.
Well, I come from a very musical family. My mom always sang, and she sang to me as a baby, and I could practically sing before I could speak. So I knew that singing was a magic key for me to many, many wonderful things, getting attention and praise, because people in my family were pretty busy and didn't have a lot of time for me. My brother had polio when I was born, and my dad had a lot of health issues, so there wasn't a lot of time for me. And singing, then people would say, oh, you have such a beautiful voice, and that was the key. Then, very interestingly, my very first experience that I remember in showbiz, I was in a community theater thing at our local church, St. Philip and St. James, and I was in a little showgirl suit, a little hot pink leotard, and my mom had covered over this floppy hat of hers, a green hat, but covered it over in hot pink, and I get to strut down the aisle singing "There's No Business Like Show Business." That's it. I remember it to this day, and I remember the people on either side, and I was hooked. And I knew the singing was the key for me. And, of course, I moved into other things, but singing was my entree to a lot of things throughout the years. I was a church soloist a lot growing up, did some of the musicals in high school, and got my equity card, first equity audition I ever went to, because I could sing.
What was your first equity production?
My first equity production was, I believe, the very, very first stock production of Fiddler on the Roof, which was directed and choreographed by Steve Baum, who had been the dance captain on the original Fiddler. And I was just in heaven. Of course, what may have helped is that wonderful friend that I had met when I was an apprentice the year before, this was 1971 I got the job, Del Brownlee, who's been my lifelong friend, had been the star of Man of La Mancha, and she became a friend and mentored me, and the music director for that show was also coincidentally the music director for Fiddler. Now, I think that I had a really good voice, but it didn't hurt to have friends in high places.
And how did you tell us about your progression from that first equity production to where you have developed over the years?
Whoa, it's been a long, long journey, but I was always interested in many facets of showbiz. I did direct a lot of shows when I was in college. That was something I was always interested in, but I had put it on the back burner because I really did have a burning desire to perform. And I'd always taken acting classes and things and continued studying. It seemed not a hard transition. I just went out for whatever I wanted, and I did a lot of jobs, not a lot of big jobs, but wow, the number of jobs I've done, when I looked at my resume and looked at my stuff, it's like, I did all that well. And then I made a decision, I think, that I really wanted to direct, and I thought I'd be less of a piece of meat. You know how actresses are piece of meats, and people are always propositioning you and rough stuff. And I thought, oh, I'll be less of a piece of meat when I become a director, which wasn't really true at all, unfortunately. But I transitioned into that. Funny thing, same mentor. I said to her one day, I said, say, Del, does that Gilbert and Sullivan Theater you work with need any directors? Oh, yes, she says, Norma's looking for a director for Iolanthe. And so I interviewed and got the job, my first directing job, professional directing job, 1977.
My goodness. And you recently directed a very well-received production of Paul Osborne's Morning at 7. Mornings at 7. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Oh, well, I loved that play. I loved the play from the time I had seen the revival that the wonderful Vivian Madeline directed on Broadway around 1981. Now, Out of the Box Theater, I had interviewed with them previously. I'd written a proposal 5, 6, 7 years ago. So out of the clear blue, they called me last year and asked me to direct. Well, I love the play, and it's kind of wonderful that there are so many roles for older actors in it. And and we just had a terrific team. The designer, Lewis Folden, who was like a Broadway-type designer, we lucked out. I don't know if you saw it, but it was amazing. The actors, it was a real ensemble production. And one of the things I love to do, it's like being a, what would you say, an armchair psychologist, because I love to work out the nitty-gritty of what's happening emotionally, and I also really delve into the context of the time that something was written. I think that's so important to understand everything about the times, the family life, social life, economics, the whole nine yards. So we had a beautiful time. One of my highlight experiences, that I love that company.
Talking about the times, you started your theater career in the, what would you say, the 70s?
Yeah. I remember interviewing for one director job, and the producer said to me, you know, I hired a woman once, and she was an idiot, so I never hired a woman again. What do you think of that? And I said, would anybody ever say, oh, I hired a guy once, and he was an idiot, so I never hired a man again? No. The other thing, though, as an actor, that years ago, back in the 70s, early 70s, you used to audition for the whole team. You'd meet the director, the choreographer, the producer, and you'd audition on stages. And now you audition in these stupid little rooms, and half the time you're seeing not even the major casting director, but like some kid, I don't want to say a flunky, because they're not necessarily all flunkies, but they send in a substitute, you know, who's like 21 years old and doesn't really know much of anything about theater yet. So when you can audition for the director or the producer. I remember being able to audition for Julie Stein and people like that. That's where it can really happen.
Right. And what are some of the highlights of, say, your acting career? Can you name three and talk about what they meant to you?
Mm-hmm. Well, gee whiz, it's hard. I've done so much more directing at this point. But, my first job at a regional theater, I got hired to do Pirates of Penzance for the Actors Theater of Louisville in 72. I was moving along pretty well back in the day. And I had a small principal role and understudied Mabel, and I did Kate, I believe. And it was a terrific experience. And we were the first show on the then new three-quarter round stage at Actors Theater. And it was just, we had a wonderful company. Ed Dixon was our Frederick, probably the oldest living Frederick, but he was glorious. He had a glorious voice. And it was a beautiful, beautiful experience. First time I had a costume designed from scratch for me. And although I wasn't pleased that I had to wear yellow, I wish I brought that picture with me. I have a picture of that, which will go into my archives at some point, I'm sure. I just have to find it. But that was one of the highlights.
And also, you brought with you some objects here. Can you talk about them? They're very interesting looking.
Yes. Well, I was in this, what's not even a B film, it was a D-rated horror film. At least Leonard Maltin, was that his name? Leonard Maltin? Maltin called it a bomb. But it was a great experience. Here's how I got the job. This should be one of my blog stories. Maybe that's the blog story for tomorrow. I went into the audition, and it was an audition room, an office in an inner room, and the producers, Eddie Adlam and the author Eddie Kelleher, that was their names, and they gave me the script and said, here, read this over, and call us when you're ready. So I'm looking at the scene, and the character's name was Karen Hunter, and it said, Karen Hunter is asleep lying down in bed, and she wakes with a start and screams. So I said, oh, okay. So I said I called out to the gentleman. I said, I'm ready. And I laid down. And as soon as they opened the door, I screamed bloody murder. I don't want to do that now. Blow your microphone out. And that's when they decided to hire me, because I had the balls or the courage to do that. And it was a fun experience. And I can't believe when I look at the film now how gol darn beautiful I was. I'm an old beauty now, but I mean, I was a beauty.
And what about the other, is it a CD or DVD?
This is a DVD. I frequently, three times I've directed for All College Theater at Trenton State College. And this is the last time I was there in 2011. I'd been dying to do Lend Me a Tenor as a director for a long, long time. And I got to do it there, and they had it was one of their main stages, and they do a pretty good job and pay a nice fee as well, I think, which doesn't hurt. And again, each time I've been there, I directed All My Sons for them back in 2006 and Sweeney Todd for them back in 1984. And each time I've been there, it's just been a great experience. In fact, I just applied to direct for them again. I'm proposing Arcadia and Virginia Woolf. We'll see what happens.
You are nonstop, Jennifer. Well, can you tell us about the third object?
Well, there's actually
very mysterious.
Well, and there's other things in here too. But yes, well, what this is, it's not really mysterious. I printed out the 20 some odd pictures from my production of Proof at the Sheboygan Theater. It is, again, one of those things on my bucket list. I know I'm holding them like I think we're doing pictures, but. Oh, my God. And I have to show you what goes with that because, let's see if I have.
And please don't forget to
well,
tell.
Oh, yeah. No. I am. I have so many things here. But I wanted to, if I can find it. Okay. I'm pausing a little bit. Sorry about that. Okay. Well, here's the sketch for the design. Wonderful designer. Don't let anybody ever tell you the community theaters are not professional type theaters. This was amazing, amazing sketch if you want to take a look at that. And the realization of the set was amazing, too. That's the actual picture of the set. And then, of course, I've got my 20 pictures here. That was, again, a peak experience. That was 2012. That was a really fantastic year, 2011-12. I did about 6 shows that year. Ended up, I think, in the summer of 2012 doing Les Mis, the school edition. I mean, it was really, really, I was going full tilt. But Proof was, oh, my God, just working out the intricacies of those relationships. And I just had a beautiful company there as well. And people, I'd love to go back there, but you know, they sometimes just rotate different directors, and that's how it works.
Community theater, that's very interesting that you mentioned that and how important it is, and what would you say contributes to the lifeblood of the American theater?
Well, I think that community theater, or just in general.
I would say community theater. Let's talk about that.
I think a lot of people have a desire to be in theater, but they don't necessarily choose it as a whole career because money, you know, a honey money is just lovely, as my friend Bill likes to say. And, you know, you wind up starving as an artist. A lot of the reason I went partly into teaching and other things and the ushering was to always have enough money and then work my other things around it. So you get a lot of people that are really professional, type professional quality people working in community theater. Even some equity people sometimes do. And I had people, same thing, when I was up in Jamestown, New York, artistic director of the theater up there. We had professional quality people that when I did nonsense up there. It was throughout my career, really wonderful people in community theater.
And tell us a little bit about how you toggle or switch back and forth between your various roles as a theater person. You're a director, an actor, singer, mm-hmm. and an educator.
Well, you just have to pick and choose. You can't do everything all of the time. And one of the things that really works is you have to know how to organize and what needs to be done at a particular time. For instance, sometimes I have ideas for different things, but if I have deadlines or timelines for things, then I need to do I need to have an ordering, a pecking order for doing things. For instance, I had deadlines of last night for the 2 submissions that I was doing for All College Theater. So between Tuesday and last night, I had to get my proposals in. Well, one of the things I do is I hold on to proposals and I keep copies so I can tweak them again. The other thing, too, when I was working on I've just done something called Seniors Finally Say Me Too, which I think I had the flyer here for somewhere in here. and I had a lot of work to do on the script and constant deadlines with rehearsals, and we were also taping for a documentary video at the same time, and I knew I had to have scripts ready at certain times, so I'd take my blocks of time and use those, and if something didn't have a deadline, then I didn't. Now, the difficult thing sometimes is I have other scripts I'm working on, and I'm also a published poet. And sometimes I have an idea for poetry, and I can't, if it doesn't have a deadline, I can jot some stuff down, but I have to spend the time on what has the deadline.
So tell us about the Me Too project. That's a current project working on right now.
Mm-hmm.
Describe it to me.
Well, yeah, my friend Carol Hollenbeck, who you may know in the theater, we came up with this idea that we wanted to do a project about harassment and specifically with seniors. And we came out with the idea in the spring of 2017, and we were dragging our feet. We had a few meetings. And then when the Harvey Weinstein stuff broke this fall, Carol says to me, you know, Jennifer, if we're going to do this, we got to do it now or it'll be too late. So I got off the, what do you call it, the pod, is that what you say? I just heard the can, and I really just got to work interviewing people, 7 women, 1 man, and some of my stories are in there too. And it's not all people about performing. It takes experiences from different facets of life, and the youngest one was one of the ladies, was 4 years old when she had her first experience. And then we go all the way up to a woman that's 85 who had an experience of being fondled on a bus. And one woman who was held captive by a relative and abused for 4 or 5 years before she got out. The stories were amazing, and me too. I came out with a lot of things that I didn't necessarily expect to, and there's some humor in it too. Well, the script wound up being about an hour and 15 minutes long, and we're going to do round 2. It's so successful. There's so much interest. In May, when I recover a little bit, I'm going to start a round 2 with other people. But yeah, it's taken a lot of my life, well over 200 hours of time to do the script and put it together. And I hope you'll come to the next performance.
It's a meaningful project. Tell me, that's sort of the adverse side of the coin. Can you talk about what the positive prospects there are for older women actors in the theater as far as roles go?
Well, it's difficult, and even now there's some more, but still a greater preponderance of roles for men. And there's still more male directors than there are females, although a lot more women out there now, too. And I think I look for things that have older actors in them, and I look for opportunities sometimes where you can do gender reversal. I was very lucky to do about 5 shows with Judith Shakespeare Company, and she did a lot of things where there were reverse roles. Men played women and women played men, and I got to do several terrific male roles while I worked with her, and addition to 1 or 2 female roles. But yeah, it has to do with female empowerment and not wanting to let women have their say. And I think we're going to see more and more roles that way. And maybe I'll be writing some things. Who knows?
We've talked about your many successes. Has there been a particular disappointment you had, a role that you had your heart set on that you didn't get, and could you reflect on that, the low point?
Wow, yeah, it's difficult. I mean, I've had so many wonderful ones, but sometimes you'll focus on a company and you'll get your heart set on something. I can remember way back in the 70s, I really wanted to be in the production of Irene on Broadway. I really wanted to be in that, and Debbie Reynolds was in it, and I thought, oh, she was like, whoa, 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 really fabulous. And I didn't get cast, and I was really, really heartbroken. But I think along the way, certainly as an actor and sometimes as a director, you have to learn to let things go. And my friend Bill, again, does a great thing. He's very good at letting things go. And recently I had a series of auditions and interviews, and this friend of mine, Carol, says, well, when are you going to hear? And I said, sometimes you never hear. And she was really surprised because she's not in showbiz. And I said, and you learn to do the audition and the interview, and if you really felt like you put your best foot forward, that's the thing, and you have to let it go. And I told a student of mine, in fact, who was taking a class. I think he might have been taking my dialect class with me. I'm not sure. Anyway, he wanted to be a director, and we were talking, and he started to send his stuff out. And I said to him, I said, well, Alan, I said, if you send out 100 resumes, you might get responses from 4 people, if you're lucky. Responses for an interview. And if you get one job out of that 100, you're going to be lucky. He goes, really? I said, yeah, really. And sometimes you're luckier than that. You know,
I see. And beyond the conversation you had with a student, what in general or specifically would you advise a young performer, a young person starting out in the theater today? What do you think they need in their armory?
Well, one thing is, I think it's important to follow your dream if that's something you want. But I think one of the important things in life is to have big dreams and little dreams side by side, so that there's small things that you can achieve. So maybe you're not going to be the big movie star or the big star on Broadway, but it doesn't mean you're not going to have a career. And be realistic and have ways of making money so you don't have to go out and be a prostitute or something like that. Call girl, $100 girl, right? You don't want to do that, or $100 boy for that case. But just have something that you can fall back on, a way of making money. And I know some friends of mine have just been bone poor. And maybe I would have done even more theater if I hadn't chosen to do a few other things. But, you know, for me, I had never planned on teaching. And I came back from being artistic director of the little theater, Lucille Little Ball Theater of Jamestown, New York. I was burned out, totally burned out. And then I sat there and said to myself, you know, maybe I'd like to do something that's not just for me. Maybe I'll apply to teach. So I sent resume into CUNY, seriously. And right away I got hired to teach at Queensborough Community College, first try. And I got an acting class and speech for the stage my first term there. I mean, it was no amount of planning will ever take the place of dumb luck, Jane, seriously. and then by 1990, that was 1996, because I left Jamestown in 95. And then in 99, I started at City College, and I haven't always gotten all the courses I want. As you get older, they kind of take some of the stuff you love away. But I'm coming up on 20 years, and it's been solid. It pays a good salary. I'm happy to say, finally, I'm up to like $100 an hour, yippee-yi-yay, and it pays my insurance, and I just work my theater stuff in between. So it was a good move for me.
Of all the various facets of your theater life, what has given you or gives you the deepest satisfaction?
Everything gives me satisfaction when it's well done. A couple of things. First of all, I was selected to do one of the very first productions of Sweeney Todd when it was released in 1984. And I had interviewed with these people the year before to direct Fifth of July. And I didn't get it. And I wanted, that was a disappointment. And then Jack McCullough calls me and says, oh, would you like to do Sweeney Todd for us? And I said, whoa. And he said, oh, yes, we knew we wanted you for that last year. And I thought to myself, why didn't you tell me you wanted me then so I wouldn't be so disappointed? And it was a mammoth project, and it was a combination of the theater and the opera department at Trenton. And we had guest artists who were professional opera singers and fabulous music director, and I love music, and I really hear music, and I know that when something is totally sung, orchestration helps you with what you're supposed to do. But wow, was that a mammoth undertaking, and boy, was I proud of that.
Tell me, as far as training goes for actors, how much, what percentage is training and what percentage is pure talent? Pure and drive is another
I think drive is as important as either. The desire. If you don't have the desire, it's not going to happen. It's good to study. It's good to take classes. I mean, in the 90s, I went and took, even though I was a little older already, I went and took classes 5 times in the UK, and boy, am I glad I did. Talent, I mean, if you have a certain charisma about you, that's going to carry across to people, too. There's one other thing I wanted to backtrack about, stuff I was really proud about. I love Shakespeare, and back in the early 2000s, I was lucky enough to work up in Alaska 2 summers in a row and got to do my own edited, revised portions of several Shakespeare things. And one of the things that I did that I was very proud of, I did my own version of The Twelfth Night, which I set in New York City. And the other thing that I was very proud of, and I'd still love to do again, I did my own version of Comedy of Errors set in post-feudal Japan. And I changed all the names and everything so that everything had, what would you say, a parallel in a place or a word in Japanese. And boy, I love Japanese culture anyway. So I just loved that, and boy, would I love to do that again.
I believe you are a mentor to many young actors and also your students. Tell us about your mentors that you had in your earlier career.
Well, I've mentioned the one so far, Delphine Brownlee, or Del Brownlee, who was a Broadway actress and just a terrific human being. And we've been friends throughout the years, and she's been very, very supportive. In fact, when I had one of my artistic directing jobs one summer, I was able to hire her to do Ethel in On Golden Pond for me, and that was just so wonderful to be able to do that. And I still give back because she used to do so many great things for me. And now I usually buy tickets to Mostly Mozart, and I treat her every summer to Mostly Mozart. I shouldn't say, she's way up there, well into her 80s now. And I'm so lucky to have had a precious friend like that. And Bill Galarno, who is also in our legacy project, has also been with me my whole adult life, a mentor and a dear, dear friend, an incredibly supportive person. Couldn't have better friends than those two. If I didn't have any other friends in life, I'd just be lucky to have people like that. You know, when you can be open with people and have unconditional love and a great relationship with friends, and then you give back as people get older, you can do a little more for them.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about your teaching career. What kind of courses are you doing now?
I'm not doing the things I really like to now, but as much, but that's okay. I've had a lot of exciting things, teaching different acting courses, intro to theater, speech for the stage. I worked a lot with Kristen Linkletter and Patsy Rodenberg back in the day, so a lot of the heart of the work I do comes from my work with them, and I love to work with Shakespeare, and I love Kristen's way of breaking open Shakespeare sonnets, and when I have a chance and I do speech with the stage, I do that as well. So I've been very lucky as far as that goes, and I keep making new discoveries. I'm teaching a lot of voice and diction these days, and I make new discoveries about things, and I'm very into anatomy of the body and the voice, and of course Kristen was very into that back in the day. I think she must be close to 90 by now. And boy, did she know. She really knew what to do with the voice, and Patsy really knew what to do with speech, and studying with both of them was amazing. So I still do a lot of voice and speech work. I do private work with people as well, coach actors and actresses on the outside when they're doing scenes or when they want to learn a dialect. Well, I happen to be pretty good with the dialects. I can work any kind of dialect you've been wanted to hear, you know. I love the Irish accent. I don't know about you, but I love... Well, I'm Irish. I'm Irish, you know. I'm making you laugh, aren't I?
Tell us...
I'm so shy. I mean, it's really terrible, isn't it? You're having a terrible time with my inability to express myself.
You talked about community theater. Can you talk about... Can you tell us about your regional theater experiences and what kind of satisfaction they gave you and how they dovetailed with all of your other aspects of your career?
Well, when you're out on the road working with people, I think there's very little difference between working with community people and regional people. I treat all actors as if they're professional, but sometimes you're in a professional setting, and actors still need extra coaching. I always call it the maieutic method, drawing stuff out of people. What was that? Socrates that did the maieutic method, drawing out. And I can remember when I did the whole season at Cortland Rep, that it was the actors were uneven. And it's your job as the director to get the best out of the actors. And we did a varied season that year. We did Pirates of Penzance, which I've done a million times, Picnic, On Golden Pond, Kiss Me, Kate, and They're Playing Our Song, which wasn't as great a show as it was cracked up to be at the time. And just getting the best out of people. You have to have an instinct for where people are coming from and how to communicate with them to get the best out of them, whether it's a star or a community person. In fact, oh boy, I have to tell you one experience I had. I directed at the Edinburgh Festival back in, I think it was 89. I was doing a tricky show called Thurber Carnival. Well, we had a television star who was the star. Television personality who was the star. He was a big star on TV at the time. He had a little problem. In fact, I really didn't realize it at the time. And he had an understudy who covered some of the rehearsals. And when he got into rehearsal, and I hope I'm not going to slip up and say his name, he had an army flak jacket on. And every time we had a break, an equity break, I guess the fellas told me, and they thought it was funny, that he had little 1-ounce bottles of alcohol in every single pocket of his flak jacket. And I guess he'd take another ounce every time there was a break. Well, he had so many problems. Now, he was the star, and I was the director, and I'm damn good, but I was not the star. And it was made clear to me by the producers, my job was to enable him to get on and do the show. So that was very, very tricky, I have to say, and made me angry also, of course.
Tell us about some of your challenges as an actor. What was the most challenging role you performed in? How can you reflect on that?
Gee, I don't really know what was the most challenging. I know one of the most exciting roles that I had a chance to do was the year that I was the guest artist down at Berea College in Kentucky. And there I was, I'm not even sure I was 30 yet, and I got a chance to do Countess Aurelia in The Mad Woman of Chaillot. And that was, oh no, I mean, it was one of those things. I got the job, and I had all these opportunities along with it, and it was a challenge, but I wasn't so worried about it. I just thought, well, of course, I'm doing the role, and I'm going to be great. I did a couple of other things in the season. I also did The Mother and the Farm that year, which wasn't that big a role, but still fun, and I got to do Rosemary Sidney and Picnic, and all this, I mean, it was, like I say, maybe I was 30, or maybe he was just 30 at the time, so boy, those were great opportunities. And you reach into yourself with whatever your experience is at the time. So if you're 30 years old and you're doing a character that's supposed to be 70, you reach in with whatever you have. And then if you do the same character again when you're 70 or 80, then you have a whole other perspective. It's the same as looking at anything. You can only do it from your own experience and imagining, endowing it with what you can. So that was an exciting year for me. I feel that, I don't know, I just meet, when I'm doing a role, I just meet whatever the challenges are and able to create a character, and that's...
Mm-hmm. Tell me, you've talked about you're going to auditions. As a director, you hold auditions.
Yes, I do.
What is your method? How do you conduct an audition?
Well, it depends on whether you're doing monologues or sides. I listen to people if they're coming in with monologues. I listen to people, and if they're reading sides, I listen, and I try to give people adjustments, and I see how look to see how people are behaving in the audition room, and look to see if they're willing and if they're able to make an adjustment. And sometimes people are lovely, but they're not able to take direction or make an adjustment. I also really have to make an assessment quickly. Are they collegial or are they egocentric? And I want collegial people with me every time. I've surrounded myself when I was way, way younger with people that weren't. And boy, that can really be a nightmare. In fact, I remember when I was at grad school at Hunter and we had the Clearman seminars. Jerry Zaks was in for the seminar one day. And somebody says, well, Mr. Zaks, what do you do if an actor just has a totally different idea for the role than you do? Without a beat, he goes, he's out of there. So I think you need to know, one, hopefully you need to know to hire collegial people that will share your vision. And if they don't, you get rid of them. Mornings at 7, there was somebody who was very, very difficult, just argumentative, and was also a member of the board. So the board member, the board says to me, they said, you know, if you feel like it's not working out and you have to fire her, go ahead. So that was very nice because I guess they knew she had a reputation. Collegiality. Collegiality uber alles.
I like that. So can you talk about some of your, let's say, directorial highlights? We've talked about Mornings at 7.
Uh-huh.
Can you talk more about what happened at La Brea?
Berea,
I'm sorry. It's Berea in Kentucky.
Oh, yeah. Well, one of the things that I've been dying to do, and, you know, he let me do everything I wanted. I was in love with the play The Lion in Winter. And I got to direct it. And, boy, it was nice because I guess when you're teaching at full time anyway, they build a research time. So I started researching the play and really I really wanted everything period right. It was so exciting. Had a terrific set. I remember we had a tripartite arches with the rounded, with the Romanesque arches, not the Gothic. So nice cast, great costuming, and I loved working on the psychology of that play. Oh my God, did I have a great time with that. And then I got to direct it again that same fall for a different company in New York, but the peak experience was doing it in Berea.
Can you talk about your singing? I know you have a trained voice, but where did you get your training?
Well, I was very, very lucky that I was God-given voice. I mean, really, I'm just so lucky, and it's still there. I was very lucky that my music teacher in junior high said to my mother it would be a crime not to get her voice lessons. So my mom would scrape together her money and drive me to lessons. I had a teacher. His name was Fritz Ebischer. And we drive out to Oyster Bay, and later on when I could drive out to a studio in Northport, New York. And I was just lucky to have a really great first voice teacher. And I learned some of my first art songs with him. In fact, one of my first songs that I sang was Where'er You Walk, from the Handel aria. And he would say, you must sing and speak as if on a pillow of air. So I never forgot that. I think more of a vibrating column of air. But he had great exercises, and I loved working with him. And in fact, I really had a sense of what was right when I went to school my freshman year. Hobart and William Smith was my undergrad school. They didn't have a big music department, but they had voice teachers outsourced to come in. And so they set me up to have a lesson with this lady named Mrs. Boyer. And I'd seen some of her students that seemed way too tense. And so I had a lesson with her. And then she was going to make an appointment with me the next week. And I remember all of 17 or 18 years old, and I looked at her and I said, thank you very much, Mrs. Boyer, but I don't think this is what I'm looking for. Well, I thought the woman would faint because I knew I just didn't feel right. And so then I outsourced and went to a lovely lady who came into Geneva once a week. Her name was Frances Babcock. And she rented a room in a local church, and I went over and took lessons with her. So I've had really great voice teachers. I love to sing. I have the soul of a singer. I need to get back to it.
Tell us something about where you grew up. What towns? You mentioned some towns. What was the town you grew up in?
Well, I was born in Manhattan. I grew up in Long Island in a town called New Hyde Park. But I also kind of grew up partly in Jamaica because I spent a lot of time with my grandparents. They farmed me out. My brother had polio. It was the early 50s. And I really didn't live at home at first. So I remember splitting time between my godmother and my grandmother, who was in Jamaica Estates, my grandmother and grandfather. And so I have fond memories of that. And, well, I don't know if this is even politically correct to say, but they had a little old fat black lady who was Black Mammy is what she really was like. And I was such a lonely child, and I remember her name was Mary Love. Did you turn the recorder off or no? You didn't? No. Okay. Her name was Mary Love, and I remember like being a little girl, and she'd sit me down they had a huge kitchen, and sit me down in the kitchen table with her and give me milk and cookies, and we would talk, and she'd go, And I was so sad when she was ill and had to go away, but she was my friend. And my first experience I had no clue that she wasn't a member of the family. I thought, and I remember, this is funny, when I was older, a little bit older, I was coming in from shopping with my grandmother, and there were some people down on Jamaica Avenue, and I knew that they were Black, but I didn't know Mary was Black. So we're getting out of the car, and I said, "Grandma, you know something funny about those Black people?" We didn't call them Black. We said the colored folks down, and she goes, "Shh." And I said, "Why?" She goes, "Well, Mary is Black, you know." And I said, "She is?" It's like, it just shows how naive and loving you are as a child.
Do you think that you were kind of isolated as a child because of your brother's illness? Do you think it made you more reflective or more outgoing? How do you think it influenced you and your subsequent career?
It made me very reflective and introspective in many ways, which is the writer-director part of me. But it also made me outgoing, and I was very shy. But I could always sing, you see. So that I might be afraid. If you were my teacher and you called on me in class, I might be really nervous. But then if you said, "Oh, would you like to sing so-and-so?" Cool. So that was, singing really was my entree to my performing life.
That's going to go resume. Can you talk about what were the most important musical parts of your career, the composers or the productions?
Well, Gilbert and Sullivan is really in my blood. I just don't know why, but it is. I really identify with it. I really absolutely love it. To me, in a way, the way they joked and lampooned was very much the way Saturday Night Live lampooned in our time. I both performed and directed. My first principal role in New York was in a Gilbert and Sullivan operetta, Patience, did the role of Saphir for the Carl Seebach Opera Company. It was a little podunk company, but heck, we performed at Fashion Institute, so it was a nice stage. And then off and on, I've done a lot of G&S. I did the Pirates of Penzance at Actors Theatre of Louisville, as I've mentioned. And I worked with a group, was amateurish, but it kept me singing. I worked with a group called Chorus 802, where they did a Gilbert and Sullivan every year. And I got to sing Buttercup and Catashaw and Mad Margaret and all sorts of other things. And then I also had the opportunity to direct for the Ridgewood Gilbert and Sullivan Opera Company, as well as for Troopers up in Connecticut, and did wonderful things. I've done Pirates of Penzance more than anything. In fact, I did a production of it at the Briar Cliff Manor High School. I was their director for a while, too. Pirates of Penzance, I've done Ruddigore, Mikado, Iolanthe, just a whole slew of things, and really love that work. And when I do that work, I'm not a major, major choreographer anymore, but I always do, it's so integrated, I always do my own work for those things. And I enjoy singing them, and I enjoy directing and choreographing them as well. In fact, when I was in the production, I was in the concert of Ruttigor with what was her name, Elizabeth, I can't remember her last name, who had worked with me out at Ridgewood, and she was doing Rose Maybud, and I did Mad Margaret. And great compliment after our concert, she said, "Oh, it's so nice to see that you practice what you preach." So not only am I a director, I'm a director who's a performer who can do, which is nice. So that was just a real plus. And I hope to go back and do some more Gilbert and Sullivan. I'm not sure when that will be. But
what's a Gilbert and Sullivan production that you haven't done that you would like to do? I mean, it seems like you've done them all.
No, I haven't. Oh, well, I haven't directed Patience, which I'd like to do. And, oh, shucks, I haven't done Utopia, which is very tricky. And but I haven't done them all, so there are some things to conquer still. There's another one, but the title of it somehow escapes me. Maybe I'm having a senior moment. Who knows? But, yeah, that's been just fabulous.
Tell me, are there some areas that we haven't discussed that you would like to tell us about or reflect upon?
Well, I just want to maybe talk about my love affair with Little Shop of Horrors. Again, I was very, very lucky to direct one of the very first productions of Little Shop of Horrors when it was released. And it's, you never know, 6 degrees of separation. I took ballet class with a lady named Celine Keller for years. And one of the people who was in that class was the old-time actress Lilia Scala, Lilies of the Field. Lilia had a young friend, Peter B., I can't remember his last name now. And when I told Lilia I was going to do the show, she put me on to Peter, who was one of the producers or assistant producers on the show downtown. So I went and saw the show, and I got treated to be meeting the cast, although Feivish Finkel was in, who I worked with in my first production of Fiddler, and got to walk through all the puppets and see how they worked firsthand. So that was great. And I directed and choreographed that production for a place called the Enchanted Hills Playhouse. I worked at some places, and I applied because I thought, oh, that's a good name. I want to work there. Same thing, I applied for a place called Laughing Horse Playhouse because I said, oh, Laughing Horses, I'm going to work. And I got, seriously, that's exactly how I picked them. But anyway, I subsequently gone on to, I did Little Shop again when I was up at the Lucille Ball Little Theater, and I did it a third time as a guest artist at Central Michigan University, which is a really nifty job, and it also paid a nice amount of money too. And I loved that, and I grew a little with each time I did it. I added things, and I had such fun. I thought I brought my pictures from that today, but I didn't, but they'll be on my website.
And so in closing, it seems like you're doing so many different things. At the moment, you're doing the Me Too Project, is that correct?
And, yes.
And so what do you have lined up for the future?
Well, the future one doesn't know 100%, but I'm going to do the second pass on the Me Too Project, and then two other things I'm working on. I like docu-style plays that are based on people's real words. Two things I'm working on. One of them is a play that I hope I'm going to have ready in time for 100-year anniversary of women's suffrage. I don't want to talk too much about it, but that's something that I'm very interested in. And dealing with some of the suffragists who weren't so much in the mainstream, like Susan B. and Elizabeth Cady, but a lot of the other people and their experiences. And I want to edit a project of mine that was called Drudges, Dolls, and Doers, Women Working the Wild West, which takes you up from Sacagawea to a lady who was, her name was Dunaway, one of the lesser-known suffragists. That needs reworking, and I think there's a venue for that again. And also working on a play about madams, about prostitutes, and one woman who was a prostitute was an anti-prostitute. So those are some of the things that I'm working on, and of course I'm going to get back to my singing as well.
And then, in further closing, I've been so impressed that you have kept and cultivated your professional relationships, that people have become friends to you and that you work together, and it's very sustaining and nurturing. Can you tell us about how much that means, the meaning of that, of the theatrical friendships that you have?
Yeah, well, you know, when we're in the theater and we're in a company, we tend to bond with people. And most of the time, people fall away. But when you keep a few treasured friendships and people ride for a long ways with you, that's it. There's no words to describe how special that is. And not everybody has long-term relationships. And when that happens, you know how blessed you are. What's life worth when there's nobody there to share or to bounce an idea off of or to let them bounce something off of you? So it's so wonderful to have relationships that last. And then sometimes you can go back and re-grab relationships. You know, when I've been close to people, one woman who was a good friend of mine 20 years ago actually came and saw Seniors Say Me Too and came all the way up from Monmouth, New Jersey to see the show last week. And we rekindled our relationship. So, that's mean, beautiful. When you love people and they love you, sometimes that just works. It's wonderful.
Thank you so much, Jennifer.